Give me an F. Give me a U. Give me a C.
Tune in August 16th from noon till 4 p.m. for KBOO's celebration of Woodstock 50 years later, featuring previously unreleased music and more from the original festival tapes, plus recent interviews with the voices of participants and musicians who attended the festival, including Country Joe of Country Joe and the Fish and Jorma Kaukonen of the original Jefferson Airplane. That's August 16th starting at noon for KBOO's celebration of Woodstock 50 years later. Tune in.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Bonds Over Borders on Tuesday, August 27th at 6 p.m. at the Cleaners at Ace Hotel in Portland. Bonds Over Borders is a benefit for Innovation Law Lab, a Portland-based organization that works to increase legal access for immigrants at detention centers, both locally and around the country. There will be live stand-up sets from Adam Passy and Dan Weber and live music by Pedro Queriega. Again, that's Bonds Over Borders on Tuesday, August 27th at 6 p.m. at the Cleaners at Ace Hotel, 403 Southwest 10th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grendel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, daily soup specials, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch. Open daily until 5 p.m. More information on the Grendel's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-9550. And now stay tuned for Wednesday Talk Radio.
That were spoken, for the blood we have spilled, for the treaties that were broken, for the leaders you have stilled. Custer died for your sin. Custer died. Custer died for yourself, for the tribes you terminated, for the myth you keep alive, for the land you confiscated, for our freedom you deprived. Custer died for your sin. Custer died for your sin. Now a new day must begin. Custer died for yourself. Truth that you pollute,
that you have cost for the good. You prostitute, and for all that we have lost, Custer died for your sin. Custer died for your sin. Now a new day must begin. Custer died.
Indeed. Floyd Red Crow Westerman, born August 17th, 1936. You are listening to Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio, and it is the second Wednesday of the month, and we're back together after a few months. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. Hello.
Jacqueline Keeler, my co-host on the second Wednesday. We're going to be talking, we're going to be revisiting the mascot issue, the long, overlong, simmering, continuing issue of, we're mainly talking about the Washington Redskins that's come up in the news again. But first, I just want to talk a little bit about Floyd. That album, it's actually not the version that you hear on the album. It's a very countrified version of Custer Died for Your Sins, which of course comes from the book by the same title by our co-host Jacqueline's relative, Vine Deloria, a very important book that came out in the 1960s and had massive influence, including on Floyd Westerman, who became kind of a troubadour of the American Indian movement. I actually saw him once at Celilo Village, at Indigenous Environmental Networks conference way back in the 90s. Anyway, that album came out in 1969, and I'm going to be featuring it on my third Thursday folk music show, The Rise When the Rooster Crows, tomorrow morning on KBOO. So I'm going to be playing maybe the entirety of the album, which I can't do all in succession because of FCC rules, but I'm going to be play that and some other of his stuff, maybe some songs of his by other people. So 1969, that album came out and had a wide resonance, certainly in Indian country. Did you say your parents had that album?
Yeah, we had all that. I kind of growing up saw that stuff and everything, so yeah.
Obviously, your parent, as you have said on the show, your parents were in the American Indian movement. Okay, so we're going to...
Well, they weren't. They helped start. They helped start the Cleveland. My dad, not my...
Okay.
Yes, then the Cleveland branch, and then... Russell Means asked my mom to start the Women's Auxiliary Group. He actually called it that. Yeah, I know. It's a long time ago.
Indeed. And Russell Means was Russell Means, after all.
Yeah.
Okay, so Floyd Westerman, that's his song. It's really worth checking him out. Sisseton Wahpeton Ayute, tribal member. He also played, you know, people might know him more from Dances with Wolves. He was the elder in there. He played in... Oh God! I think he was in many, many movies that featured Native American themes or had a Native American character. He also collaborated with Jackson Browne, Willie Nelson, Bonnie Raitt, Joni Mitchell, Kris Kristofferson, and Buffy St. Marie. And as I said, he ended up after his long musical career, mainly doing benefits and live performances for the cause, he ended up appearing in many, many films and TV shows. We miss him. He died in 2007. So that's Floyd Westerman. I have just a few quick announcements. Stop the Killings in the Philippines. Join Portland Committee for Human Rights in the Philippines today, 5:30 to 6:30 at Pioneer Courthouse Square. A year ago, this time, seven peace advocates with the National Democratic Front were murdered in their sleep by the armed forces of the Philippines. And many, many people continue to be killed by that vicious regime. And related to that, tomorrow at the Social Justice Action Center, which is at 400 Southeast 12th, Climate Justice Knows No Borders, also join the Committee for Human Rights in the Philippines with their environmental justice group at from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Social Justice Access Center. That's tomorrow, 400 Southeast 12th. This evening at BARC, 351 Northeast 18th Avenue. That's the Forest Watchdog Group. What is the future of fire in the Cascades? Join Andy McAvoy as he presents his research on forest fire in the Cascade Range. That's what I've got for today. What have you got, Jackie?
Oh, gosh. It seems like some things don't go away.
Yeah.
They just don't give up. So, yeah, I guess, you know, as a journalist, I write about a lot of issues. And sometimes these issues keep coming back. And you think you've written the piece that finally really, you know, I put a lot of work into my writing. And in 2016, I addressed a horrible poll that the Washington Post had commissioned, which they claimed proved that most Native Americans were, you know, just fine with being mascotted as Redskins, right? This, you know, referring to, you know, basically they claim it's our color of our skin, but there's a lot of historical, you know, information that ties it to a much more gruesome tradition of bounty hunting of Native people, of bloody scalps, and then of course there's the issue of it promoting racism and stereotypes, and in our nation's capital.
And it's connected to so many other the Chief Wahoo, the ridiculous Cleveland Indians mascot.
Yes, so
there's a whole broader context.
There is, yeah. and there's a lot of studies that have come out, and I go over that in my writing quite extensively over and over again. I've been on MSNBC, on all kinds of places, explaining this over and over again, and yet here we have this billionaire Dan Snyder who still wants. You know, he wants his free publicly funded stadium. He's out shopping around looking for another billionaire to help sponsor it. You know, and he was actually going around the Caribbean, the Mediterranean, in his $180 million yacht, cozying up to different other yacht owners, trying to get them to fund his stadium.
Please tell me they don't have a Redskins logo on the yacht.
God, I don't even want to look. And so the Washington Post this past week did another poll 3 years later, or they wrote an article about a poll that is very badly sourced, and basically saying once again, Native people love being, you know, they really love being mascotted, you know. And so I'm a board member of the Native American Journalists Association, and our organization released a statement, which is linked in the website for this page, for this program.
Okay.
And so basically, you know, explaining that. That the Washington Post, demanding really that the Washington Post retract unreliable data sets and all associated reporting with this poll.
You wonder about the timing, like why even do it?
Well, you know, I've talked to some of my sources. So the article I wrote in 2016, I wrote for The Nation magazine, which is also linked on your website, which is on, it's titled On the Shameful and Skewed Redskins Poll. Which actually came out in May 2016, and is subtitled "The Washington Post Did a Grave Disservice by Utterly Ignoring Studies That Clearly Demonstrate the Harm Mascotting Causes," and this article was, you know, the Nation. When you write stuff for the Nation and stuff, they go through and they fact check everything. They challenge you on every single statement you make. Everything has to be vetted. And then they also sent a series of questions to the Washington Post itself and asked them to respond. So everything in this article is not just me going off in some sort of editorial rampage. It's actually been pretty thoroughly, researched and checked. And the data, the problem with the data over and over again in these polls is that they rely on self-identified Indians. So you have people that they've randomly called, and they basically say, "I'm an Indian. I think it's okay."
So wait a second. They call people and ask them if they're Native American.
Yes.
Okay.
Because, you know, to get the randomized data set, you have to you sort of have to just randomly choose people, so you don't know if they're Native or not when you call them. And so, and
there's
so
they
a lot
must
of,
have to call a lot of people.
Yes, and there's a real this was a sort of a technique that evolved when everyone had landlines and everyone would answer the phone, and really it's sort of become incredibly skewed because who answers the phone? Who has a landline nowadays? It's older white people. Do you know what I mean? And so what happened when I looked at the data for their 2016 poll, what I found was that like the average age was like 54. It was like really old. They were in the southeast of America. And as you know, like most, there was this thing called the Trail of Tears, in which a great deal of Native people, most of the Native people of the southern states were forced marched to Oklahoma, to Indian Territory. And so, you know, there are Native populations down there, but they are very small. They're people who have, you know, sort of remnant populations, you know. And
there's a lot of people who, you know, being somewhat vague about their ancestry may have heard some story about some ancestor.
Exactly. Like Elizabeth Warren, a lot of people in the South may think that they're part Indian. And there's a whole history to that, which I've gone into a great deal with my writings by, you know, I've interviewed a lot of Native historians and genealogists for these tribes, and they tell me that a lot of this is tied to land claims. You know, their families have tried to make spurious land claims to Indian lands at different points. Some of this is actually due to white families having black ancestry. So, like the term Blackfeet, you meet a lot of people from the South who think they're Blackfeet. The Blackfeet tribe is in Montana and Canada. Right, and it's very far north, and these people have no ancestry west of the Mississippi River. These people are part black, you know. That's what the term in the South. That's what the term meant, you know.
And of course, there were populations of biracial and triracial,
exactly.
You know, and over the years, but again, the whole issue of formal or more direct, you know, more community based. Identification is what you're talking about.
Well, you know, yeah, community-based and also political. I mean, right. We are sovereign nations. We're not just, you know, I mean, I always say, you know, I'm a 16th French, but doesn't make me a French national, doesn't give me any claims to, you know, anything having to do with France, really, you know, other than descent. And what does that even mean?
So these polls have a series of serious problems that you said the Washington Post was given questions. Did they address those questions?
Well, you know, they were given questions. They attempted to address them, but you know, pretty much my editors of The Nation didn't feel like their answers were very good, you know. And then I even did go head to head with Nate Silver. His podcast covered my article, and you know, and a couple of his staff members were, you know, supportive of my point of view and my findings, but he was very dismissive. And he was like, no, the result's fine, you know. And yet, I come from a Native family and from two tribes. Both my parents are Native American, and my cousins and are all enrolled in mostly two tribes, the Yankton Sioux Tribe and the Navajo Nation, but are also enrolled in many other tribes because my aunts and uncles have married other Native people from other tribes. And I was, and pretty much every, I would say every single cousin I have is enrolled tribally in a federally recognized tribe. And none of them support the mascot. So it's like, how do you get a thing where, like, you know, over 90% of Native people, I mean, as a Native person, you would know that dad is bad.
And you've been out and about. You've talked to a lot of people.
Yes. And so, you know, I looked at the data more carefully, the fact that most of the respondents were from the southeast of the United States, where there are a few Native people or Native large populations, where they are old, when, you know, Native people have a very short, we die a lot younger than most, and they were mostly male. And so, you know, our male elderly population is quite low because of the high rate of death for Native men. You know, Native men have the highest rates of on every scale you can imagine, even death by police. You know, I think, you know, the data, it's not great data, but the data does show that they have the highest rate of death by police, of death on every single measure. You would never do a survey randomly that would actually give you mostly older Native men from the Southeast. That's just not, you know, how do you correct for that? That's just, you know.
So let's cut to the chase. So why why another poll and why another article in the Washington Post?
I can't help but feel like it's tied to this whole stadium thing and stuff.
Now, what's going on with this? I didn't understand.
They're building a new stadium and they're getting public funds and they're trying to get more, you know, support. I don't think they had a great year last year. I mean, if you read like some of those, like Reddit forums of fans from D.C., you know, they really hate Dan Snyder. You know, they don't love him. And a lot of them are hoping that Bezos will buy the team.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and Bezos, of course, owns the Washington Post. And I wasn't able to confirm any sort of, you know, any connection there. But you know, I did talk to some sources who used to work at the paper. And they feel that it was tied to the fact that the subscriptions, most of the subscribers are older. The paper subscriptions and they need to keep those levels up and so they're appealing to them. The editorial board of the Washington Post utterly opposes mascotting Native people and they've made that clear, but the news section and other sections act independently, and so that sentiment is not carried through the entire paper.
So I just want to let people know other than the fact that this is Wednesday Talk Radio, and I'm the host, Paul Rowland, and my co-host is Jacqueline Keeler, we are a call-in show, and the number to call in and talk to us is 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. So, yes, anything else about this Washington Post? I mean, the Washington Post, the Washington Redskins...
Well, you know, it's interesting because, I've gone over the whole data of how it impacts Native youth and their self-esteem. You know, here you have a group that is, by any measure, the most vulnerable population of young people in this country. You know, suicide, have had the highest suicide rates. I think young Native men, you know, between the ages of like 18 and 25 have the highest suicide rates by far. You know, of any different, of any group. I mean, so it's, you know, to put that kind of pressure, if any study shows that this diminishes their self-esteem and reduces it and makes them more vulnerable, we shouldn't be putting any pressure on those groups. And certainly stereotyping them to their peers does that, promoting stereotypes in their educational experience anywhere. And so it's a pretty dangerous thing to be doing, so, you know, just for basically entertainment's sake.
I mean, it must be hard enough to live in a, you know, look all around you and know in either fully consciously or less fully consciously that you're living in the land that was, you know, your people were once free in and have been thoroughly colonized, and then to basically be made fun of or be made, you know, the object of these ridiculous stereotypes, to be kind of thrown in your face continually, must be.
Well, that, and then what this whole episode, recurring episode, shows is that there is, that the white population is not aware to the extent that they pretend to be Indian. You know, and actually, I, looking at my article from 2016, I see that I actually did quote the response from the polling director at the Washington Post, Scott Clement, and he says, "We see little reason to suspect respondents would intentionally misreport their racial identity or tribal status to a confidential survey." Yeah. And so there's this idea that they can't believe this is actually a thing. And yet it is pretendianism and you know, basically what I call mimicking Native identity by white people is so common. It's actually like a national pastime. And we see this a lot with even in academia, where, you know, academic institutions aren't allowed to like racially profile their applicants, but they do want to bring in a diverse group of teaching faculty, and so many of the people they bring in are pretendians, because they can't ask those questions, you know, and so it's makes it really difficult, because we are faced with a situation where even the people who are, you know, getting these are salaries that could really go to an actual Native family. you know, and really, and we're always measured the poorest economically of any group in the country, you know, to be, for white people to be pretending to be us and to take those salaries and to be in, and to do that scholarship for us in performance to other white people. It just baffles the mind. It shows the extent to which, you know, the genocide and the taking of the land, to which they need to make it okay, you know.
And it's, well, you probably don't want to try to, you know, plumb the strange psychological depths of us white Americans, but I mean, I think there's part of it, you know, don't you think part of it is this like search for authenticity, or, you know, it's like, you know, because I think that in the 60s, that, you know, once Native people became okay, you know, sort of, you know, through the, you know, American Indian movement and through, you know, Little Big Man, films like Little Big Man, there was sort of, and sort of the zeitgeist sort of was sort of, and the hippie, sort of the hippie image, the idea that, you know, and the environmental ethic, you know, the Native elder shedding a tear when the garbage was thrown on the side of the road in that famous advertisement.
And that was the Pretendian service guy too.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway,
so I think there is this deep, well, you know, guilt, this sort of deep underlying guilt that I think is kind of just at the basis in,
well,
some ways,
again,
of American culture.
Again, trying to make the genocide and the appropriation of Native homelands okay, and it's not authenticity if it's not true. You know, I mean,
well, I said the search for authenticity.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, that's not a search for authenticity. That's a search for something else if it's not based in any kind of reality. You know, I think, you know, so often when we confront these pretendians, and I, you know, did some reporting in 2015, which was in the Daily Beast, about Susan Taff Reed, who was hired by Dartmouth College to be their Native American program director. And, you know, a Native genealogist, you know, she runs a blog called Ancestor Stealing, accurately, did her genealogy and found that her family had only arrived in this country in the 20th century from Ireland, you know, and it was very easy to document her grandfather, who claimed to be Indian, his entirely Irish ancestry, you know, and on top of that, the fake tribe he started, a nonprofit, actually was found, many of the leaders were found guilty in the 1990s of running Lenape sex magic sweat lodges in which they molested 13-year-old girls. They went to federal prison for that in Ohio. And so they were his fake tribe was based in Pennsylvania, but they were tried in Ohio, because I think that's where they were running some of them. And so, you know, and it does have shades of Jeffrey Epstein and these sort of white men, you know, sort of acting in collusion with each other to create circles to have access to, without accountability, do you know what I mean, to prey on children and other people. So there's an element to which it is preying on Native people, and that's not a search for authenticity, that's a search for power. You know, so once again, this is an act of aggression. It's not an act of love or of appreciation, because if they really did, they would actually center actual Native people.
Well, we got a caller. Looks like it's Wade. Let's go to Wade. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you? I have a personal anecdote in support of your claim. My previous wife, it was popular then, and even when I was in high school 5 years earlier, too, and this is back late 70s, so late 80s, but to pretend to be, as you said, I guess you could even stretch it out to be pretend Indian, but I guess it gets difficult to say, pretend to bees or something. But many people would claim to be, oh, yeah, I'm Cherokee, or I'm Arapaho or something. She'd go, oh, really? Well, my grandmother is Lakota Sioux, and my grandfather is Yak Alaskan, which nobody had ever heard of course. Nobody had ever claimed to be Yak Alaskan, right?
Not that I've heard of.
Right, so that you have to have a little more knowledge in order to be closer to the truth of your identity.
Okay.
There's more than just a couple of tribes out there.
Yeah, I mean,
and that was their limited knowledge and their claim. So
Well, there are just a few tribes that everyone seems to claim. Of course, Blackfeet, Apache, everyone wants to be related to Geronimo. Right. And of course, Cherokee. I mean, the Cherokee
Geronimo
Nation.
Geronimo's a bastardization. I forget his real name, but it's not that.
I'm my mother's Navajo, and you know, of course, the Apache are our close cousins. I mean, to the Navajo people, we can understand each other's language. And
you mentioned French too. The Blackfeet would be pied noir, so perhaps they didn't wear shoes. I had dark.
Well,
you know,
this was in the Southeast, and
okay,
it's a guess,
okay. But thanks for calling with that information.
Black, you know, the black again. Okay, so thanks. Peace.
Okay. Bye.
Yeah, I think one of the problems with people, pretending to be us is that they present stereotypes as being our identity, and they are not clued into our actual stories and needs, and so it leads to a lot of it's once again that phenomenon of like where white people, well, you know, it's so funny. There was a study that came out in 2017. It was done by, it was funded by the Kellogg Foundation through a group called Reclaiming Native Truth, right? And what they, invited me to come down and to see the result, to hear, you know, their results and from the study. And what they found was that it's a very interesting data set, actually. It's what they found was one that they did focus groups and everything, and they found that white people prefer to see other white people performing being Indian. They really like that, and because it enforces group cohesion. And the performance of our culture, they like that a lot.
That really connects it pretty directly and strongly to the blackface.
Yes, and it's interesting because the study also found that that only like 35% of the respondents understood the mascot issue or had any sympathy for it. Right. And yet when they polled about Standing Rock, and it was much higher, it was closer to 80% understood the issue and were sympathetic to it because it was a political issue to them. And it was clear, you know. So it shows that this mascot issue is really difficult for on a lot of levels to get across. And actually, you know, when I was really active in the group, I started Eradicating Offensive Native Masketry, which we were the ones that started the Not Your Mascot hashtag during the Super Bowl in 2014. We're the ones who launched that hashtag, Not Your Mascot. And one of the things we did a lot was in 2014 was we spent a lot of time putting Dan Snyder in the news, all his crazy stuff he was doing to try to fight us, you know, and I think that made a lot of headway in the issue to make a white billionaire guy look ridiculous, and also tapped into a lot of the frustration that the fans had with his ownership of the team, right, and by associating him and his arrogance with the mascotting of Native people, we were actually getting a lot of support that way. I think he stopped playing ball with us after a while, so we couldn't generate the same amount of news. I think he started listening to his press advisors. So, but he seems to be engaging us again.
Actually, I don't know how much you're referring to this article, Native American Imposters Keep Corrupting the Redskins Debate, which also discussed that. But there's a couple interesting things in there maybe we could talk about having to do with what you were saying about people falsely claiming to be Native American and actually, you know, taking money, in this case, falsely claiming to be Cherokee Nation citizens, draining $300 million in government contracts set aside for Native-run business. I know that's something you've, you know, independently talked about. But anyway, we've got Phil, Rachel, and Andy, a full slate. So let's go to Phil first. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, I'm working in my office. I'm listening to this. I'm catching most of it in my sort of peripheral because I'm trying to get some work done. And the word that I keep hearing over and over and over is stereotype. Now, I heard something about a poll where the average male was 54 years old, really old. I guess it depends on your perspective. I don't know how your speaker, what her age is, but there are a lot of people out there who would not consider 54 years old really old. So the word that I keep hearing over and over and over is stereotypical. I would caution your speaker to not stereotype age groups.
Well, for the purpose
I'm
of
54.
The purpose of the study was to get sort of a, to talk to the Native population, and the Native population is an extremely young population. So if you wanted to get a if the study accurately through a randomized selection process had accurately depicted the Native population, it would not have a median age like that, and it would not be from the Deep South. You know, if most of your respondents are 50 over the age of 55 and from Alabama, they are not likely to be Native people.
Well, I heard this out of just sort of peripheral.
It's a critique of the study and its methodology.
Yeah, well, I felt that your comment was more personalized from your own.
Well, for the very low the very low life expectancy of Native people, it is elderly.
Okay, well, she's explained it. Well, thanks. Thank you for calling in with your point. Appreciate it. Let's go straight to Rachel. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Is this for Rachel?
Yep.
Yeah, hi. Just by the way, as an aside, I'm over 60, and I got what you were saying about the age thing, so I did not offend me at all. I am Black and Native American. My tribe was Lenni Lenape. They were in the Delaware Valley area. They are not a registered tribe. And I found it fascinating what you were saying, and I've seen this myself about white people who claim to be Indians. And it's always the Cherokee. I mean, in my travels, I've traveled a bit around this country. I've been in many trainings, and some white person would inevitably get up, and say they were 132nd Cherokee. Always the 132nd Cherokee. And I thought, well, this is BS. I mean, why is it always that fraction? Why is it always Cherokee? And on the flip side, I find it fascinating that because I do look more African American, I'm identified as African American by most people in this country, and when I tell white people that, oh yes, I'm also, one quarter Native American, they get this perplexed look on their face like they didn't know that ever happened, that Black people and Indians ever got together. You know, it's just they just have never figured that out. And I just wondered if you would, I wanted to make my statement, and just wondered if you had any comments about that or not. Thank
yeah,
you.
I think, this brings up a lot of issues. One being, that Native people are not a race. We are nationalities. We're citizens of nations, and we can be of any race. You know, it's not a racial classification. When we talk about these percentages and everything, it's not our tradition to measure our identity by these percentages, by blood quantum, right? This is something that was imposed on us by, the federal government. And, and the purpose of it, of course, was to for us to get to the point where we were so, quote unquote, such a small quantity of Native that we didn't count anymore, right? And but really, what that is it's a snapshot in time of who was a citizen of our nation. It'd be like saying you're such and such percentage of Revolutionary War blood. Do you know what I mean? Imagine you had to be at least 25% Revolutionary War blood to be able to keep your American citizenship. That's just how ridiculous it is, And we're not a race, and that's actually not a scientific thing at all. We are a nationality, and our identity is political. And this is why our identity is so threatening to the U.S. government and to the colonists, is because it implies, when you are a sovereign nation, it implies sovereign rights to the land and to the resources in the land, and this threatens the U.S.'s whole, sovereignty over our homelands. And so as far as the Lenape go, I was really working on the article. When I started working on the article for the Daily Beast in 2015, I didn't know a lot about the Delaware and Lenape. I should tell that everyone that the Lenape people, that is their name for themselves, but they were called the Delaware after, I think, Lord Delaware. Delaware. So there are tribes, federally recognized tribes in Oklahoma, two of them that are Delaware tribes, and some remnant populations in other native communities, I think one in Wisconsin. And I know my husband's Six Nations in Canada, they had some folks who had fled and joined them. But there are groups like the Lenni Lenape who are, stayed, remnant groups and survived in the onslaught that happened in the Northeast. And certainly a number of tribes, did that. And of course, our president, Mr. Trump, of course, is infamous for telling Indians when he was fighting them in the whole casino issue in the 1990s that they didn't look Indian to him because, of course, to him they looked black, right? And so that was just this horrific moment. Our identities and our individual national stories are so distinct, and they deserve to be known. And they reflect what our people, each of our individual people, faced in the onslaught of colonization and invasion, and how we survived.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for calling in.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you.
And before we go to Andy and then Harry, I just want to let people know that coming up next on Making Contact, they take a look at the history of Hawaii. At 9:30 on It's Got Science from the Union of Concerned Scientists, with a discussion about how to keep the power on during a climate crisis. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And after that, at 11, the Dirtbag welcomes your calls to talk about a new technique or something else new you tried in your garden this year. Don't forget, you can hear all these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you haven't yet done so and would like to become a member, go to KBOO.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. And of course, the program page for Wednesday Talk Radio is also available on our website at KBOO.fm, and you can get some of the links that Jacqueline referred to. And well, let's just go straight to Andy. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi there. Good morning, and thank you, first of all, for hosting this discussion. It's been really interesting. I also have to apologize that I kind of caught it about halfway through, so apologies if this has already been brought up. The issue of Native appropriation and this like caricatures used for sports logos is something that we face here in Portland. I think people are very quick to forget that the Portland Winterhawks exist.
Yes.
There is a racist caricature painted all over the Moda Center and Veterans Memorial Coliseum. That team is headquartered and a home in Memorial Coliseum, which is owned by the city of Portland. Like, it continues to be a huge source of frustration that this is not more of an issue locally, that people don't really talk about this, but I figured in line with the discussion that you're hosting this morning, it seemed like a good opportunity. I've never called into a show like this before to raise this. This is happening here, just like a lot of things that we feel are happening at a national level, but we're sort of tucked away in the Pacific Northwest in this quick little liberal bastion. Like, no, it's all happening here too.
I think that might have something to do with, like, that, Portland's cool, so, like, the Winterhawks must be cool, too, right?
Well, I'm really glad you brought this up. And the ironic thing with the Winterhawks is that they only have that mascot because they got hand-me-down jerseys from the Blackhawks in Chicago. Yeah. And so it's not even some great traditionary thing. You're right. It needs to change. You're bringing up the city ownership of Memorial Coliseum, and the issue there is we would one of the things that my group EONM tried to do was to try to get cities to publicly owned facilities to ban red face, and we actually did this in 2000. I think it was 2014. My cousin was attending a game for the what's the team called there in San Francisco? It's the baseball team there.
The Giants?
Yes, a Giants game. And they're having their Native American Heritage Night. So a lot of the Native American urban Native community there were there. And his name is Kimball Big Horse. And he's a Stanford grad. And he was there with his little family. And this young woman came up to him and said, asked him to go with her. He's a pretty big Indian guy. He's a former football player. So she asked him to come with her, this young Native woman. And she went up and challenged this guy who was wearing a headdress. This wet-looking guy, and she got him to give her the headdress. But then he called the security on her and him, and so they were forced to give the headdress back to him. And then they were escorted out of the stadium, and then they were jumped by San Francisco police. And he woke me up at midnight, sending me video of this. You couldn't even, this guy, my cousin is like, what, 6'4" or something, and you couldn't even see him. He had police all over him. He was on the ground. You could just see his feet. And they actually, this young woman was quite small, and they lifted her up by her hair and threw her to the ground and twisted her arm behind her back, and all because they challenged this white guy wearing a headdress. And so you just mentioned Dennis Bernstein, his show's coming up. He actually championed this cause there in San Francisco, in the Bay Area, and actually knew the owner of the team and was able to get us to sit down and talk to him. And he agreed to ban Red Face from the stadium when the Giants are playing there. And so we would like to see the city of Portland do that, get rid of Red Face from their publicly owned venues.
So caller, there's a, if you're not already, you know, active in too many causes, you know, there you could start a little campaign if you want.
Yeah, I'd be willing to help if I can.
Okay, well, thank you for calling. And looks like we got Harry up next. Go ahead, Harry.
Oh, greetings, everyone, and thank you for taking my call. And welcome back, Paul. We missed you.
Thank you.
We did miss you.
And anyway, the owner of the Washington Redskins, what reason does he give of keeping that name? Is he on record what actually he said, why he's not changing it?
What was his quote? He gave a very a quote we can't repeat fully on air. Basically that he's just an arrogant billionaire. It's he's going to do what he wants to do.
Oh.
And
he doesn't appeal to tradition.
What did he say? What did he say? He said something really, really he gave an awful response. Just to think of, like, I can't even, it was just like, you know, just F words. You know, yeah, it's his team. He's going to do what he wants. That's just it. You know, that's what he said. And he said that you could, and he said you can reprint that in caps. Yeah. Oh. I mean, he's just a jerk. He is an entitled, you know, he gave a lot of money to Trump. Yeah, I mean, he's just that kind of guy.
Well, I was born in Washington, D.C., and I remember in the early days, in the 60s, they had a different helmet. It was a lance with a feather on it, and they changed it to the helmet that they have now, which is actually a portrait of a Native American male. And I'm trying to figure out why they do this, and can they at least change that back, or... You know.
Well, I think that, you know, the whole thing has to change. I mean, and it's really not necessary to mascot Native people. I mean, it's not a necessary thing. And the price that Native people pay, you know, is so high. You know, studies show that there was a study done at Stanford by Dr. Stephanie Freiberg. She's a Tulalip tribal member. And she found that Native students, when they were exposed to Native mascots, experienced a huge plummet in self-esteem and the ability to believe that they could achieve their dreams. And it was worse, actually, for Native students who said they were okay with mascots, which indicates that they're allocating a huge amount of energy to make it okay. You know, so it's, you know, and Native youth are the most vulnerable population in the country, bar none. They have the highest suicide rates. You know, young Native men have like 9 times the suicide rate of any other population in the country. I mean, they can't sustain this. They can't, it's not fair to put this on them. So, you know, just let it go. And you know, and there are plenty of other things to mascot. And actually, you know, Emory University did a study in 2015 in which they found that they looked at all the colleges and universities that gave up native mascots, and they found that that 2 years after they gave up the native mascots, their fan base was more engaged with the new mascot than they'd ever been with the native mascot, which suggests that they actually did have issues with it. They just weren't aware of it. And they actually calculated how much money, the Cleveland Indians and were losing, which is a franchise that, you know, couldn't afford to lose the money, and it was quite a bit. And so I would suggest you check out that study, Emory University, 2015. It's, you know, there's really no reason.
Okay. My next question is about naming different things, like motor vehicles. There's a Dakota, there's a Dakota pickup truck. There's a Tacoma pickup truck. There's, you know, different cars and things named after Native, you know, the Jeep
and weapons.
Cherokee.
And weapons, know. Too, you know. I think that, that's all part and parcel of the same sort of trophyism that came out of this idea that, you know, of conquering.
So you see a connection between the reference of Redskin to basically a trophy of war and the naming of cultural artifacts.
Yeah, I think it can't be disentangled because of who's doing the naming. Do you know what I mean? And it reflects that relationship. It has to. And, it's very different when Native people are doing things, you know, I think that reflects their own relationship to their own identity, which is far more informed by actual factual things, not just stereotypes.
Well, okay, thank you for answering my question.
Sure.
Thank you,
Harry. Have a nice day.
Okay, let's go to our last caller, because there's something I wanted to talk about that we hadn't talked about yet, if you want to talk about it. But let's go to Elliot, who's been patiently waiting.
Yeah. I have a fascinating point to make regarding my own conservation activism back east. There's a place near New Paltz, New York, called the Gunks, which is sort of the Yosemite rock climbing mecca of the east. And there, where I've been in conservation active all my life, there was this woman whose whole family has Dutch-English names, and she owned a panoramic rock outcrop, which, based on Native American Lenape heritage, she called Turtle Hill. And a corporate land trust of a resort corporation, Mohonk Mountain House, wanted to kind of landlock her and take the area over. And I said to her, please, you know, you say you have Native American heritage, and that's why you'll never give up the deed to this landlocked parcel. But please go to the state of New York and get some public easement conservation protection to protect yourself against this corporate land trust. And she said, even she looks white as snow, and you know, she said to me, "Well, no, I can't do that because it's our Native American heritage." And she would go up there once a year with like Native American war paint on.
Oh my God! Did she have any ties to actual tribes? Like.
Well, look, the actual parcel was part of the last deed owned controlled by a Lenape in that county of upstate New York. But there was no biological proof in terms of like ancestry.com or anything that she was Native American.
That's very common in places where Native people were removed. I mean, you have to realize that, you know, after the Revolutionary War was fought to gain access to lands west of the of King George III's proclamation line of 1763, in which he forbade colonists to pursue land claims west of the Appalachian Mountains. And so so that really angered the colonists, particularly the wealthy ones who were doing land speculating, like George Washington and many others. And this is one of the main causes of the Revolutionary War. So once they won the Revolutionary War, then they went in and just swept away those tribes. And so my husband's, he's Iroquois, Mohawk, And his ancestor, Chief Joseph Brant, fought the colonists, and he ended up in Canada for that.
Yeah, Brant was in the Rhinebeck Valley.
Joseph Brant. Yeah, that's my
science that, about Brant.
Yeah, that's my husband's.
It leads to almost infinite perversity.
Yeah, well, the problem when we were moved, then of course that leaves a vacuum, and then fakes can then can do whatever they want.
Okay.
So.
Well, thanks for calling. We got to wrap it up here. Appreciate your call, Elliot, and to everybody else who called. So, I'm kind of springing this on you, but I did want to refer to this. You can go with me or not, but this the El Paso shooter wrote this manifesto, and I don't know if you read it, but I think it's worth noting because it gets to this whole sordid history of our fraught, at best, fraught relationship, us European Americans' relationship with the indigenous peoples. He basically says that some people will think this statement is hypocritical because of the nearly complete ethnic and cultural destruction brought to the Native Americans by European ancestors. But this just reinforces my point. The natives didn't take the invasion of Europeans seriously.
Yeah, that's not, he obviously doesn't know history. You know, I think, actually it's so funny because one of the things I just posted was actually about Chief Joseph Brant, my husband's ancestor, who is my children's eighth great grandfather. And I knew about his leadership during the Revolutionary War, against the colonists, right, joining with the British to fight on the British side. But he was defending his homelands because he knew that once the colonists won, that they would take New York State. Most of upstate New York was, of course, it was the Iroquois Confederacy for 1,000 years. You know, that nation stood there. But I recently read in Canada, of course, they follow his history a lot more because that's where he ended up. But he continued after the Revolutionary War to continue coming to the United States and working with the Ohio tribes, working in Detroit with the tribes there, encouraging a Western Confederacy to stop the continued, incursion of the invasion of their lands, trying to coordinate an offering that the Six Nations warriors would come and help, sure. You know, from Canada to fight. He was traveling.
So he took it very. He took it very seriously.
He went to London. He went to Philadelphia. Met with George Washington. Even though he was in Canada at this point, he already lost his homelands. You know, he was going all. I mean, this is during the 1700s. He was traveling to Marietta, Ohio, to attend meetings, to Detroit. You know, going across the ocean to Ohio to meet with. To meet with King George III, all of these things he was doing to fight this diplomatically, using war, everything you could think of, he tried. And I think to say that we didn't do that, is to diminish the real stakes and what really happened. And also, it's
just one of the many overt or deviously subtle ways that the American mind goes when it's unable to actually confront the reality, the real history.
Yeah. And stereotypes feed into this. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that's a big part of it. I think what we need are a much more mature and actual understanding of each other to build a better future together. Because we do have a future together. What it's going to be like depends on an ability to really know and speak to each other. So that's why I think understanding Native people authentically, and I mean authentically, not out of a desire to be us, but a real allowing a space in the public in our actual lives space.
So other than your writing, which I recommend highly, and we've linked to quite a few articles, and you've got a book coming out, which we probably don't want to talk about, and we don't have time to talk about the linking
and
the
a news magazine
and a new magazine.
Yeah, Pollination.
Pollination, Nation, Pollination.
Our first issue is coming out on Indigenous Peoples Day on October 14th.
Awesome, yes. Awesome. But do you have any, this is such a deep subject, the twisted nature. I know Vine DeLoria obviously wrote a lot, but who are some of the the more interesting Native writers and thinkers exploring these issues.
And I should mention that, you know, my book Standoff will be coming out during the election, 2020 election, and we'll be looking particularly at the rise of Trump and the rise of this cultural war, you know, and my perspective covering different issues like the Bundys and Standing Rock. I think that there are a pretty, you know, I think, who do I, of course, yeah, I read a lot of my own family's writing, you know, including my Aunt Ella Deloria, my great aunt. And there are so many amazing writers out there. I can't give them all.
We'll devote a program to that in the future. Besides, we're out of time.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you so much, Jackie. All right. This has been Paul Rowland with Jacqueline Keeler, my second Wednesday co-host with Wednesday Talk Radio. Thanks for listening.
KBU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Unity, a night of feminist Latinx BDX hip-hop, Tuesday, August 28th at 9 p.m. at the Dog for Lunch in Portland. Unity features artists Maria Advertencia Lirica from Oaxaca, Valentina Peralta from Chile, Portland's Kayla J, and DJ La Pausi. Nunca fuimos de viaje a Japón. This event is also sponsored by Colectivo Ruda and Cup Hub Creative. Again, la mula no era arisca, pero la hicieron. That's Unity, a night of feminist Latinx PDX hip-hop, Tuesday, August 28th at 9 p.m. at the Dog Fair Lounge, 830 E. Burnside Street in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under community events.
KBU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Feminist Film Night and Planned Parenthood fundraiser on Friday, August 16th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. This Planned Parenthood fundraiser will screen A Girl Like Her, which tells the hidden history of over a million young women who became pregnant in the 1950s and 60s and were banished to maternity homes to give birth and surrender their babies for adoption. And Jane, an Abortion Service, a documentary of Jane. The Chicago-based women's health group who performed nearly 12,000 safe illegal abortions between 1969 and 1973. There will be a conversation after the films between a former Jane, Judith Arcana, and a girl like her, Lonnie Jo Lee. Again, that's the Feminist Film Night and Planned Parenthood fundraiser on Friday, August 16th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Making Contact, taking a look at the history of Hawaii. At 9:30, it's Got Science from the Union of Concerned Scientists with a discussion about how to keep the power on during a climate crisis. At 10, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And then at 11, the Dirtbag welcomes your